For September 7th, 2017, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 216. I'm Matt Clavis, senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, co-host of the show, senior front-end dev, 1992 Murray Middle School Geography B champion, Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, glad you're here.
Thanks. Thanks for being here with me.
Hey, super exciting topic today because we are talking about making stuff really work, right? As a user, it sucks when websites are slow.
Really, really fast. I actually have a story for you. So long before I joined Lullabot, I went to DrupalCon Denver and I took this awesome class. It was called Performance with the Dream Team.
Oh, yeah.
And two of the Dream Team are actually on here with us along with someone else. The first person on the Dream Team is a coworker of mine, Quick Sketch on the interwebs. He's a founding co-worker of Backdrop CMS, has major contributions to Drupal, WebForm, and images. He's been with Lullabot for over 11 years. I think you're like employee number one or something.
Three or four, right? Yeah.
He's the go-to guy at Lullabot for performance audits, architecture, and consulting. Welcome, Nate Lampton.
Hi, guys. Great to be back on the Lullabot Podcast.
Yeah. Glad you're here. Also with us today is a previous guest. We had him on a few episodes ago, a very early Drupal adopter, user number 3313. He's part of the team that drove the first high-profile public Drupal use case with the Howard Dean campaign in 2003. He's now the co-founder and head of product at Pantheon. It's Josh Koenig. Hey, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad you're here.
The second person that was on the Dream Team that I took at DrupalCon Denver has been on Drupal.org for over 10 years, 9 months, database maintainer and member of the Drupal security team. The guy in the Drupal community that is most often found answering the question, will it scale? He's a Pantheon CTO and co-founder. Welcome, David Strauss.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey David, I have a thought actually. This is one of my early impressions of David Strauss is I saw a video of you at it was like a community core conversation or something at some conference where you were demonstrating how you were making a Damienized Drupal process. How'd that work out for you? That was many years ago.
The exact method that I used is not really around anymore. I think that was back in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
However, PHP runtime has better support than ever for this. In the sense of being able to just fire up PHP and have it run an HTTP server for things like local dev. I haven't tried it out myself because for probably not too surprising reasons, when I do dev and test things, it's usually just on Pantheon. But it's a pretty awesome tool in the sense of being able to fire up that quick environment. It's what attracted a lot of people to things like Rails early on and these kind of quick prototyping and development tools. And the more accessible we can make PHP and to a larger extent Drupal, the more we can continue to refresh the community with new development talent and new people building new websites.
I guess the statement behind that is this is kind of a topic that you've been thinking about for a long time. A lot of times people think about using Drupal or a CMS of its nature, and they think, man, that's big and bulky, and that's going to make my website slow. And people don't like slow websites.
Yeah, it turns out Josh was just bringing up as we were prepping out for the talk today, just how much information and research is going into that now.
Yeah, there's more and more. I mean, a huge, pretty large and growing body of research. It's not like it's a surprise to anyone. Anybody who's a user of the web, as we all are, experiences frustration, waiting for things to load, waiting for things being slow. Like, is it my Wi-Fi? If I'm on my phone, it's like, is it the cell network? But it's just it's a bad user experience. And we now have like large commerce companies that care about this incredibly deeply because for them, like 1% difference in terms of people abandoning a shopping cart or falling through on a purchase is a really big deal. But you have just, a lot of people who have been very incentivized to look into this question deeply to the point where we now have kind of realistic statistics on what kind of penalty you'll pay for an extra second of forcing your end user to wait.
Yeah. The numbers that I've seen aggregated by organizations like Moz and HubSpot are that once you're starting to load the page in more than about 2 seconds, if you take substantially more than 2 seconds, you can lose 2/3 of your conversion rate. And conversion doesn't necessarily have to mean someone buying a product. It could mean signing up for a podcast. It could mean registering to volunteer with an organization. Whatever the website is designed to accomplish, users will accomplish it more with a fast site.
So you mentioned that after two seconds or so, the conversions will fall off. Does that affect mobile also?
Oh, it affects mobile pretty severely, and that is why companies like Google are pushing new tools to start the performance conversation on the mobile side. For example, one of the tools that's integrated in current versions of Chrome, and it's a fairly new tool, is called Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. And what Lighthouse does is it analyzes a website from the perspective of a mobile device. The mobile performance is so important and so bearing on every aspect of how people interact with the site, even on desktop, in terms of how the performances are architected, that by starting the conversation on the mobile side and starting the analysis on the mobile side, we often can confront every single issue that is necessary. I've started using kind of a slogan of all performance is front-end mobile performance, in the sense that if you have bad back-end performance, that's going to show up in front-end mobile. If you have really heavy pages, it's going to show up in front-end mobile. If you have too much JavaScript and too much execution time before things are interactive, it's going to show up on mobile. And all those are going to show up more severely on mobile than they will on desktop. And that allows you to hone in on the most important things to confront for performance. Often people zero in on the back end without necessarily analyzing how the back end is affecting the overall user experience. Often the backend is less than 30% of the user experience. And when you're caching pages, the backend may be less than 10% of the user experience in terms of the influence. Mm-hmm. And it's just really sad when I see someone trying to analyze a site and the site loads in 10 seconds and they're trying to shave 100 milliseconds off the backend. It's just not going to deliver a great experience. It's just not a great use of time.
So when you're looking, for example, in like browser-based developer tools, how do you tell how quickly the back end has performed versus the front end?
Well, it comes down to a few things. The first metric that really matters is called time to first byte. There are articles written all over the web, and especially from CDNs, about how much it is the most important metric versus just a metric. But there are a few indisputable things about time to first byte. One is that most analysis shows that is the criterion that Google uses for PageRank. In terms of Google started talking about 5 years ago that they were going to start using website performance as part of PageRank, and all the correlation analysis shows that time to first byte is the bedrock of that. It seems to be the influencer. Time to first byte is when the from the moment that the web browser knows it's loading a web page. The duration from, say, pressing enter in the address bar to actually getting the first byte of HTML or HTTP response back from the server. And it's important for PageRank. It's also important for other performance because it's basically your starting line in the race. That it determines where on the track you are starting. If your time to first byte is 400 milliseconds, then you're not going to be able to do absolutely anything else on the web page until that byte gets delivered. The web browser is not going to be able to load any of the assets like JavaScript, images, or CSS, and it's not going to be able to start rendering until well after that point, because it doesn't even start getting the response until that point. So while it's not everything, and it typically doesn't dominate the actual end user load time, it's one of those things where nothing else is happening before that point. And so you want to be moving that back to give yourself as much headroom as possible. And that's why CDNs get really important for this, because it's one of the only things that can allow you to, as Josh likes to say, beat the speed of light for loading a page.
Sure.
Also, to kind of tie that back to the question I think you asked initially, though, in a case where you like have a poor performing website, very frequently that starts with a really long time to first byte. And if you have a really long time to first byte, it's very likely that that has to do with like your core backend server side performance. Like you have a slow application and it's not doing any caching and, you know, it's running a bunch of expensive queries to even figure out what the response is. And so if that's your starting place, until you, like, it may be the case that, you know, you just have to live with that and you can optimize a bunch on the front end to do as well as you can. But if you have a very slow time to first byte, you are like, to David's same point, you're like starting the race a few seconds after everybody else, which is just not a great place to be in.
Yeah, you can't make up time in a race after a certain point, especially if your goal is to have the complete page render in about 2 seconds.
What is a good target for you when you're thinking about a website, time to first byte? Before you even consider a CDN, we'll get into that in a second. How fast is fast enough for you?
So Google starts discriminating against your site after about 400 milliseconds for your time to first byte.
So 0.4 of a second, right?
Any time before that, any time less than that, Google's not really going to apply much of a penalty, it seems. So let's say you're beating that, you're pleasing Google. Really, any further optimizations are just to give you a little bit more headroom for your rendering time for the site. Yeah, for every 100 milliseconds you shave off of that is another 100 milliseconds off the page load. So there are different thresholds to hit, like in terms of the 400 milliseconds, but after you pleased Google, it's pretty much just something that gets added to the sum of loading the page. So it's if you have the opportunity to optimize other things on the front end to shave off more time, then those might be more important if your time to first byte is already less than 400 milliseconds.
And for anybody who's like as a user of the web and a builder of the web, right? One of the ways that, I mean, I know what's going on, so I can observe this like affecting my psychology and behavior as a user. Time to first byte is the point where in like my browser, it stops being the throbber that like it's trying to make a connection, and then like that stops throbbing, and then usually within a second or two later, I start to see a page render. The time to first byte is that kind of like unknown interim time where it's still doing like the spirally throbber thing, and that's where again, if that's long, you're going to lose people because there's like nothing signaling. Like, is there anybody out there? We don't really know. We haven't gotten even our first byte of data back, and so that's why it's important to get that down. Like David's saying, Google uses that as a signal in rankings, but probably, yeah, I would agree that like, you know, you can maximize it more to be able to just be faster, but under, you know, 0.4 of a second, you're probably doing pretty good.
Yeah. Another way to look at it in terms of especially all the assets and stuff is that, let's say you're cooking a meal and, it takes a long time to get you the recipe for the thing you're about to cook. You can't go shopping for the ingredients until you actually get the recipe. And you certainly can't start cooking the meal until you've got the ingredients and actually started and have the recipe in hand. So a slow time to first byte is asking someone to cook a meal and basically holding out on giving them the recipe for it.
It makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about front-end performance and maybe like time to first paint and time to first interaction?
Yeah. Google is also emphasizing these now, even though it doesn't seem to be something that actually bears on PageRank, at least yet. I wouldn't be shocked if it starts to, given all of their investment in tools. But there are a few thresholds. There's time to first paint, which is where the browser actually starts putting the first items on the page, where it has enough information that it can start rendering things. Google has also introduced a term called time to first meaningful paint, which is where once the actual primary content for the page is showing on the screen. It doesn't mean it's interactive yet, but it means that you're getting more than, say, just a navigation bar at the top of the page. That is the number that Google is starting to emphasize most, because once a user gets something that they can start looking at and scrolling around, they get a lot more patient for remaining things to load, like interaction. And then time to first, and then the other measure that is starting to be on the rise is not just time to first interaction, but time to first stable interaction. I might be getting the phrase a little bit wrong, but the idea is once the page is interactive, is it responsive? Is it low latency as I'm scrolling around? Do the buttons remain pushable, or does something else load right after the buttons become pushable that somehow locks them up? And so what Google's looking for now with Lighthouse is that at what point does the page kind of stabilize where the buttons are pressable and they remain pressable for the rest of the duration of the load time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think everybody can agree with that, where you've been on your phone and you load up the web page and you can see that the web page is there, but then you hit the menu button and the menu button does nothing. And that's just because the JavaScript has not finished executing, so that button does not know what to do to open up whatever menu.
I don't know, the one that bugs me, Mike, is when you have the page loaded and you try to click something, but the DOM totally shifts because the ad loads, and then, yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of the metric they're using for time first meaningful paint. If the items on the page shift around a lot, they generally count that as not the first meaningful paint. Mm-hmm. The first meaningful one you achieve is when the position starts stabilizing and the main content is visible. And it looks like I haven't dived into the source code yet, and it is an open source tool with the Lighthouse stuff, but it looks like they're actually doing some image analysis to determine what the time to first meaningful paint is in terms of looking at how much it's altering at each stage of rendering and re-rendering the page. And if something shifts all the content around or suddenly shows a giant amount of content on the page, they typically count anything occurring before that as not the first meaningful paint.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if you go into, Chrome Developer Tools, you can look at the film strip view on the timeline and performance tab. And that kind of shows you like a little film strip view of your website as it's loading with, little time markers there. And you can kind of eye it yourself, which is pretty neat.
I should mention that this is available in Chrome under the audit tools under developer interface.
Yep.
And there's a kind of a, to me, there's like, again, this continuum of, improvement that comes along. Like, one of the things that I've appreciated more and more in terms of observing people using products, like just observing people using our product, is how frequently this fundamental psychology of taking an action and waiting for confirmation really influences people's behavior. So you get like all along this spectrum of front-end performance, you have these little checkpoints that you want to be able to hit. So like your time to first byte, that's your fundamental starting line for your performance, but also there's going to be some feedback from any device that a user is using when you hit the time to first byte mark. And that's going to keep more of your users engaged. And time to first paint, even if it's not meaningful, I know that even like, I'm loading a newspaper site and maybe they're using a fancy font library, so the frame of the stuff loads a second before the text actually becomes visible. But the fact that frame loaded, especially if it loaded quickly, it kind of just makes me want to give it a, give them the benefit of the doubt that they're going to like let me read their content in a reasonable amount of time. And then of course, like you want to get to this point where things are no longer popping in and popping out, and you don't want to frustrate people with this experience of having set them up to think that they're ready to interact with your website, but then actually almost like clickjacking them into tapping on a banner ad that popped up unexpectedly. So it's really just, if you think about the psychology of using the web, and you can kind of interrogate your own life experience to understand how these markers for front-end performance really matter to people. And then, again, what we're seeing increasingly loud and clear is our page ranking overlords at Google definitely care about this stuff in terms of who gets ranked above what. Like, all of the things being equal, the fastest site will rise. And that the user behavior is influenced by this at scale. Like, there's it's actually not powered by Lighthouse yet. We were looking at this the other day. They have a mobile device speed test that's like testmysite.syncwithgoogle.com, and it actually goes to the point of advising you as to how many users you are losing because of performance based on their audit.
That is now powered by Lighthouse. Last I checked.
Oh, really?
I think they switched it over.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
At least when I went in and had them send the detail report, it sent me an email and said powered by Lighthouse 2.0 in the report.
Sweet.
So let's talk about optimizing the front end, so we can, let's say I can look in my Chrome Developer Tools and I see that, hey, my, I'm getting my first byte in 300 milliseconds and, the HTML is downloading in 100 milliseconds, but the web page is taking, another couple seconds to render. Like, how do I go about troubleshooting that? How do I fix these issues? And when do I realize I have an issue?
This happens because designers hate us, right, Mike?
Yeah, I can think of a couple.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as web pages become more and more complex with different interactions and things, I mean, it becomes a struggle to optimize your front end.
Yeah, I think to me there's this there's kind of an interesting parallel between, you know, in our experience on the back end. It's one of the first things you want to try to understand is like, is your problem one that could be solved just by essentially improving the technology that you're using? You know, and the analog and backend performances, if you're not using PHP 7, you're just wasting everyone's life. And because it's like significantly faster with no downsides, you know, you can get it to work for your website if you spend a few hours doing it, even if you have some legacy code, and it's just like so much more efficient, it's not even funny. And on the front end side of that, that's where CDNs come into play and all this other stuff. So like there's a number of technology solutions that you can use to just David used the phrase that I throw around, like beating the speed of light. It's understanding that even though the speed of light is really fast, the distances we actually travel in order to fetch all of our data are surprisingly long because of the number of round trips that need to be made to actually successfully set up HTTP connect, set up TCP connections, negotiate security, and then do the HTTP request, and then multiply that by n times for the number of things that are on a page. And so even though it seems like the speed of light is a very fast thing, it's a constant in the universe, but if you're going back and forth between wherever you happen to be, you know, and halfway across the continental United States, like forget internationally, just from like if I'm going from here to Denver and I have to do it like 100 times, that's actually not going to be very fast at the speed of light. It's going to introduce meaningful lag. And by the way, data doesn't actually move at the speed of light through fiber optic networks. It's about 2/3 of the speed of light because of the way it all works. So there's this whole thing where you want to understand whether your slowness, whether or not you can attack some of your performance problems by upgrading the technology that you're using versus needing to attack the performance problems by looking at how your web page itself is constructed. So the counterexample would be you could optimize the heck out of all of your networking, all of your HTTP, all of that other stuff. And if you have like a blocking piece of JavaScript that depends on a third-party service that prevents the render of the whole page until this ad unit loads, and that service decides that they're going to have a bad day, it doesn't matter. Because you're still going to just basically hold up the page render on something that's outside of your control, and your users are going to get bored and leave. Yeah. And so that's a fundamental thing you just need to understand. Like, what is... can you apply technology to improve your performance? Because if so, that's usually a pretty straightforward process and will get you wins across the board. Or are you looking at needing to optimize kind of like on the back end side, like, do I need to worry about this slow query and like refactor my code? Or can I just like upgrade the version of PHP? And knowing which side of the line you're on when you're trying to do that work is really fundamentally important so that you understand, you know, where you're diving in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's on the diving into the application side, that's like really kind of where there's some very cutting edge development going on at this point. You know, like you're saying, there's this incredible tension between more rich user experiences and potentially deep, complex and layered design requirements, and then the need to make them all come together really quickly. And that's a super exciting space to be operating in.
Yeah, something that I'm like seeing, like you know, like especially with like all the new single page app stuff, like React or Angular, you know, every time I look at that, like we're looking at like Webpack, and Webpack does code splitting, so it'll actually look at what your JavaScript's doing and then only send you that JavaScript code, and then if you go to a different page, it'll send you that code, and that significantly reduces your bundle size. And so your bundle size is, you know, when you're doing React and I don't know everything else that NPM throws in there, you could be downloading, you know, potentially up to, you know, 1 megabyte or more of JavaScript. And if it can split that up based on per page, that can dramatically speed things up. But the fact that you're downloading 1 megabyte of JavaScript to me still boggles my mind, you know, coming from like something like, I remember like back in 2005, I used to run my own agency, and I remember I would think, I want to keep these websites under 60 kilobytes because everybody's on the dial up, you know, and I would make these small real estate websites, and I'm like, all right, 60 kilobytes, if I can keep it under that, it's going to load fast. And now, you know, we're talking about keeping everything under 1 megabyte or like, and I've done websites that have like large background images and fancy parallax effects and stuff like that. And we're talking about like understanding how the browser's rendering and painting and compositing the website and layouts and all that type of stuff and all this animation. And it gets complicated really, really fast.
Yeah, Mike, you've talked about your front end performance work you did on Sci-Fi, right? You've given some Drupal camp talks and that kind of thing, where scroll interactions and making sure the browser isn't repainting, and the amount of time you can save on that side of things is pretty immense at times.
Yeah, so if you're doing like any type of like animations, like there's a bad way to do it and a good way to do it. The good way to do that type of stuff is to use stuff like transforms and opacity, because that's done more on the compositing layer. When your browser's building out your website, you have like after it downloads everything and forms like the DOM and the CSS object model, it then creates the render tree. And once it has the render tree, it can do what's called layout or reflow, and that's where it actually like starts like putting stuff around the around your web page, and I'll say, all right, this goes to the left, this goes to the right, this goes down, this goes up. And that's a really expensive operation to carry out. And if you go somewhere, if you're doing animations that's forcing that relayout over and over and over again, especially if you're doing stuff like scrolling and it does a relayout based on every single scroll event, that's when you end up with like parallax websites and it's stuttering and stuff like that. And the same thing happens, the next step in that process is painting, and that's when your browser just like filling in those squares with various different colors and stuff like that, just like you think it would. Like that's also an expensive operation. And the last thing on there is compositing, and that's a very cheap operation because it's done on your computer's GPU. And that is where like it'll take various different layers of paintings and it'll just kind of write them to the screen. And it's very easy if you're using like transforms and you can do different things to promote them to their own layers, or if you're affecting opacity, it can move those around fairly cheaply without, you know, making your computer cry. And stuff like that is really, it's important to do, but it's hard, honestly. And I really don't have anything else besides that. I don't even know where I'm going.
Well, no, I think you're on it. And it's funny, I have some friends that work in the gaming industry. Mm-hmm. And they've been in that world for quite a while. And I remember just talking to them about the types of things that they think about in terms of, you know, I'm thinking back to like when the PlayStation 2 was first coming out, and they're just like, you just have to understand the way in which the system processes the different parameters you throw at it to render the result in order to build something that is like a 60 frames per second interaction and works. And like you mm-hmm. said, there's usually there's a good way to do it and a lot of increasingly not good ways to do it, up to like seriously bad ways to do it. And it that's why I think this is such an exciting area for the web, because historically speaking, like, well, I think this is wrong fundamentally, but in a lot of cases, historically speaking, people have thought of the front end as like the not technical part of web development.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's first of all always been incorrect, but it's increasingly obvious that that is totally backwards. And you have like you're talking about with building with React and Webpack, like you're delivering an application via, and the browser is just like your medium. The browser is your PlayStation 2, and you're slotting in your disk to run for the user, and you have to understand how that's going to work. And the challenge is, it's not actually a PlayStation 2; it could be one of 1,000 different devices. And all those things, like, you know, you're talking about like a megabyte of JavaScript after it's been, you know, gzipped and minified and everything. You know, most of us are on fast enough networks where the download time for that isn't so bad. But, you know, where it gets really hairy is on mobile, and not just because of the download time, because that still could be okay. But the CPU constraints on the mobile side are something that people really underestimate a lot of times, because they're doing all the dev on you know, a MacBook Pro with four CPUs that are all like Intel i7s and 16 gigabytes of RAM. And they're like, this just looks amazing. Just here's my giant monitor. This is like beautiful. We're scrolling through all this stuff. And like, you try to load that website on your phone and like, you almost have to put it down right away. It gets so hot.
Which is not just even an effect on the page load time, it kills the battery on phones, and is part of why so many sites have opted for going in the kind of native app direction, because they've never really investigated how much weight the doing HTML5 style stuff is causing, and how much optimization can be done there. But it also affects just the costs of users. If you want accessibility in a developing country, you start having to worry about things like the actual cost for downloading the page. If you use webpagetest.org, it links to it has a little kind of dollar sign indicator, almost like looking at a restaurant review, for the general kind of weight of the page and how much it costs different people. And you can click that link and actually see, in terms of raw cost as well as purchasing power parity for the people who live in that country, how much it costs to download it. It's not uncommon for a site to cost 25 to 50 cents US to actually download and render on a device. And that is not sustainable for a lot of the developing world.
For one page load?
I can believe that. You know, if they're charging 50 cents a, you know, a megabyte or you know, I don't know, 10 cents a megabyte, and your website is 5 megabytes large.
Making the trade-off of viewing your website or eating is kind of a... I don't know.
It's definitely the website. Go with the website.
Says the web developer, yeah.
Yeah. Also, Google has done some research into the bandwidth of mobile users. This is another thing that they're trying to push through the Lighthouse tool. And according to their research, about 70% of users will be on 3G connections or worse in an empirical fashion through 2020. And by empirical, I mean they might literally be connected over a 4G protocol, but for reasons of, say, network congestion or the kind of signal quality that they're getting, they're practically using a 3G connection.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, this past weekend I was up in North Georgia to watch a solar eclipse way out in the boonies. And, of course, I had, you know, the worst cell phone connection ever. And it was really, really painful. And, you know, even, excuse me, back down here in Gainesville, you know, there's college football down here. On game days, like, everybody comes into town, saturates the mobile networks, and it just becomes almost useless the closer you get to the stadium. In addition to that, something that hasn't been mentioned yet is, as soon as you're on mobile, you have to deal with latency. You know, there's that latency for those cell phone towers to actually translate your stuff into radio waves and shoot that out. And that can add, like, you know, 100 to 200 milliseconds per HTTP request. And that, you know, starts adding up pretty quickly.
Oh, a lot of people also haven't heard of this kind of factoid, but a lot of mobile networks load sites substantially faster over IPv6 now than they can over IPv4.
Really?
Because for IPv4, the addresses are so scarce that many providers are using carrier-grade NAT for that. So they're performing translations and sending you through a couple of additional servers and routers in order to connect with IPv4, whereas IPv6 is often a native thing on the network, and you get a real routable address for the phone, and it actually has to pass through fewer devices. It's part of why companies like Apple are requiring for all iOS apps now that they're able to connect to services over IPv6, because IPv4 support is already inferior on mobile networks for the most part.
Wasn't the internet going to explode a few years ago because we were going to run out of addresses?
We keep pushing it out with NAT, okay. But the price we pay is in more and more layers of NAT. It used to be you got a real IP address on your phone, or IPv4 address on your phone, but many people, especially in developing countries like India, are behind one or two layers of carrier-grade NAT and get just a sort of LAN address on their phone for V4, but they get a real IPv6 address.
So before we go too much further, who wants to do a quick 1 minute explanation of what IP is, IPv4, V6, and NAT?
Well, IPv4 is the original internet address system.
Okay.
When people see something like 192.168.0.1 on their computer, or 10.0.0.1, or in the case of Google's DNS server, 8.8.8.8, that's an IPv4 address. It's mm-hmm. a 32-bit number, which means that it can address about 4 billion devices. And this seemed more than adequate when the internet was first coming about for the TCP-based internet around the late 80s and early 90s. And it became clear as the 90s marched on that this was eventually going to run out and become a problem. And we've done all sorts of things to extend the life of that approach. One thing that we've done to extend the life of it is called NAT. It's Network Address Translation. It means that the building or house only gets one IP address, not an IP address for every single device. And then the router pulls tricks to allow the devices within the house or building to all connect to sites on the internet by basically pretending that they're all coming from that same one main IP for the building or house. And that saves on addresses. It's created all sorts of complications in terms of applications, especially games. But it allowed it to extend the life of the IPv4 addresses for another 10 or 15 years beyond what was expected.
And just to point in to call back earlier in the discussion, that's one of the reasons why data doesn't move at the speed of light. Like, there's a fundamental reason, which is that in a fiber optic cable, like, it's actually not going in a straight line. It's bouncing back and forth inside the cable. That's where you get down to like 66% the speed of light over a straight cable. But every time you go through a layer of NAT, that means that like the signal has to be decoded back into electrical impulses, which move through a series of transistors that run some logic to basically figure out what to do with this packet. And you know, carrier grade NAT is fast, like as you expect from something called carrier grade, but it's like orders of magnitude slower than just photons bouncing their way down a tube of glass. And so as you add more and more layers of this like translation and retranslation, it slows down the time it takes to move a bit from point A to point B.
That totally makes sense.
And I think David, I'm not sure you made it to IPv6 as a description, but it's just another way to number addresses that has many, many more addresses. I remember our sysadmin at Lullabot just saying, "There, I just dedicated a billion addresses to something," just because it's, I mean, the massive numbers.
Hopefully, we're not just showing hubris again this time in terms of using a design that we think will offer enough addresses for the foreseeable future. But there's a lot more to convince us that's the case, in the sense that IPv6 addresses have 128 bits, which I believe was enough bits to address something like every atom in the known universe or something. It was something ridiculous. Now, we don't use it that efficiently. In practice, we actually exploit the fact that we have a massive amount of addresses to go back to some of the early 90s approaches to addressing, where we can we can use class-based routing, which is where we can structure the networks a little bit easier and make the logic simpler on routers. Which, going back to what Josh was saying, is like every time we actually have to process a packet, we want to do it as fast as possible. And IPv6 was designed from the beginning to facilitate that.
Well, keep in mind that 640K of memory is more than anyone will ever need. So we are talking performance on the web with David Strauss and Josh Koenig. We haven't yet heard a whole lot from Nate Lampton. We're going to get with him and talk about web performance, making that website run faster. Also, we need to get into running faster than the speed of light. We'll be on that coming up right after this.
How's it going?
Super. How's it going?
I'm doing all right.
Hey, it's Pantheon's agency and community engineer, Steve Persh. So tell me what's going on. What kind of training are you doing at Pantheon? What's the deal?
We work with agencies directly a whole lot. We go to conferences, we write blog posts, work on example repositories, mm-hmm. and a lot of this year's focus has been direct training with agencies. So we'll get on video calls for an hour at a time, often 4 hours at a time, 2 days in a row, and we'll walk through a lot of Pantheon fundamentals. Like the dev test live workflow is pretty much the core feature of Pantheon that any Drupal or WordPress site, you've got your live environment. And then before that, you've got dev and test to do all kinds of development tasks. So we make sure that developers have a good grasp of that workflow.
Learning a new tool like Drupal might be daunting, but then when we put it on Pantheon, that's a whole other tool set, and being able to use it to its fullest extent is super important. So your training is going to help that out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really oriented around developer workflow. So pretty much everyone on the team comes from a background of working inside Drupal or WordPress. We all have opinions about how best to build a Drupal site inside of Drupal, but these trainings are mainly focused on tools that supplement Drupal or WordPress. So we'll talk about Drush and WP CLI, things like that.
Steve, I've known you for years in the Drupal community,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have experience doing Drupal. So yes, it's Drupal hosting, but Drupal people behind that. And that's exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's really nice to be at a company that has this deep Drupal history. The founders of Pantheon are all very deep in the Drupal community. And we've now been in the WordPress space a good while, too, and that's been fun to see. I started in WordPress now 11 years ago when I first started making websites semi-professionally. WordPress 2.something got the job done. And then, yeah, pretty quickly after that, somewhere around 2007, 2008, switched over to Drupal as my main focus.
So this may not be training that's like, how do I build my Drupal 8 module, right?
Right.
That we can go to Drupalize Me, or, you know, there's plenty
exactly.
other places to
yeah.
go.
Yeah.
But this is like, you know, how do I make my latest code live in the most smooth way possible?
And ideally, how do I make sure that it's correct? Not only how do I make it live, how do I make sure I didn't break anything? So a lot of what we've been talking about this year is testing in some way, shape, or form. Some of my coworkers on that agency and community team have been talking a lot about visual regression testing at DrupalCon and a few other conferences, basically showing like anytime core gets updated or plugin updates come out, make a new Pantheon multi-dev environment, take pictures before and after the security updates have been applied. And that's one way of knowing with some level of certainty that the security update didn't break anything. Like if no pixels are moving when you fix that MySQL injection vulnerability, it's a good indication that the site is is not broken. And then BHAT is something that I've been pretty focused on this year for behavior-driven development, making sure that regressions aren't happening, and sometimes more importantly, making sure you know what you're going to build before you start trying to build it.
So if I'm a Pantheon user that needs to talk to you, Steve, and get some of this training, how do we do that?
So if you're a Pantheon agency user, you probably have a contact, a partner manager. You might know who that person is, Ryan Sears, Ben Rosales, a few other people. And then if you're not certain or you're new to Pantheon, pantheon.io/agencies/learnpantheon is the place to go.
Welcome back. We're talking about performance with Josh Koenig and David Strauss from Pantheon, along with Lullabot's own Nate Lampton. Nate, you've done performance audits for Lullabot in the past for some pretty prominent clients. Are there any ones that we can talk about that are not under NDA? And can you tell us what's involved?
Yeah, we've done audits for all kinds of companies, a lot of educational institutions like Harvard, and audits for a lot of, surprisingly, for technology companies, game development companies, software development companies, not website software development companies, but all of these audits that we typically get are of course, for Drupal sites, because we've got a lot of Drupal expertise. And a lot of the focus on these audits is typically on making Drupal return things faster. So there's not, like, we do include front-end audits, but the focus for and to almost always be going back to the beginning of the podcast, talking about like first byte delivery, making sure that Drupal can actually, your application can actually return responses back to the user as fast as possible. What that typically looks like, we go through all of technology layers, and that usually starts, honestly, even without using any fancy tools or anything, looking through web browser and seeing, you know, what is that first time to the time to first byte. And if that time to first byte is taking a long time. Unfortunately, almost the quickest win all of the time is to cover up all of the problems that are in whatever your backend is and put caching in front of it. And that typically means the Drupal page cache, of course. If that's working, you're already going to be in a pretty good shape. And then to increase the time on top of that, a reverse proxy like Varnish, and then to increase the performance on that, a CDN like Fastly or Akamai.
That is Drupal page caching being used is kind of the is it plugged in question, right?
Yeah, it really is. And the time to first byte, like David was saying earlier, like less than 400 milliseconds is where you want to be to not get dinged by Drupal, or by Drupal, by Google. Less than 400 milliseconds is easily achievable if your Drupal page cache is working in the first place. You should be getting, you know, with the Drupal page cache functioning correctly, like that should easily get you under 150 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds for your response plus the network latency, which, you know, that could maybe be like an extra 200 milliseconds. So even with, if your page cache is working, you're already in a pretty good place. And then putting something like Varnish on top of it, let's say you take that 150 millisecond, 200 millisecond response from Drupal, and that gets cut down to like 4 or 5 milliseconds because Varnish is insanely fast, or any Nginx is another great reverse proxy. That cuts out the response time from Drupal and makes it so that it's really just almost returned instantaneously, as close as we can get, really. And then now you're only talking about network latency. And that's where a CDN comes in, that a CDN makes it so cached copies of your website and your responses live closer to the user, and you might be able to take something that takes 200 milliseconds of network latency and cut that down to maybe 100 milliseconds or 50 if they're really close to a web server nearby that has a copy of that particular request.
What happens, Nate, if the website actually, like if something like page cache or just caching everything and shoving it at the user doesn't necessarily fit the needs of the website? I mean, there are times that personalized content is important. How do you get around that kind of thing?
Right. So regardless of whether or not your site is entirely flat or like super highly dynamic, you still want to make sure that as much of the web page as possible is underneath that cached umbrella. And maybe the time to first byte only includes the non-dynamic parts of the page, the non-personalized parts of the page. And then you populate those dynamic parts after page load via AJAX, probably, to make it so that the initial responsiveness of the website still feels ridiculously fast. And then the challenging parts that actually take highly customized responses, that happens after the page load.
I would also throw in that when you're talking about a use case where you have the need to do dynamic or personalized content, kind of thinking about where you're allocating your resources, page caching tends to really still be really important because even, you know, unless the entire website is behind a login form, in which case that's your constraint and you're dealing with it. Unless the entire website is behind a login form, it's highly likely that a lot of the traffic comes through to landing pages and other pieces of a website that are appropriate to cache, even if only for a little while, or if you need to refresh them quickly, you can do that dynamically with a good caching layer and a good CDN. And so what you're doing there is you're saying, hey, let's cache the things that are appropriate to cache so that all of our backend resources can be devoted to serving the dynamic pages when they're requested. And that gives you the best possible use case, like the best possible scenario for delivering for those dynamic pages. Versus if you just sort of give up and turn page caching off, what you're doing is you're making Drupal and the server that it's running on do really repetitive, busy work of like dynamically reassembling the exact same response over and over and over again. And it doesn't get any easier if you don't cache it. So it's kind of like you have like only so many CPU cycles in any given minute to be able to throw at any problem. And if you can't, and using page caching might like solve your problem completely, or at a minimum, it'll let you hoard your CPU cycles for where they're truly needed versus having to allocate them across a bunch of cases and then be like, you know, potentially come up short when you're delivering dynamic pages and have slower responses there.
Now, Drupal 8 has a new caching system and also now has BigPipe in core. Are any of you familiar with that and can maybe explain what that is?
I've been looking at BigPipe a fair bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just for people who aren't familiar with it, what BigPipe does is actually somewhat similar in philosophy to what we were talking about at the very beginning around some of that work I had done prior to DrupalCon Copenhagen about the idea of bootstrap once and handle responses, what BigPipe does is it bootstraps Drupal once, it pumps out the initial kind of framework of the page and essential content, and then streams that out to the user's browser so that they get the initial framework of the page, can start rendering the page, and then within that same request can send additional enhancements to the page without having to re-bootstrap Drupal and without having to have the client establish a new connection if they're using a traditional protocol like HTTP 1.1. I have some mixed views on exactly whether that is the perfect approach going forward, in the sense of it relies on PHP pumping cache data through its own system, which basically requires handling a whole bunch of strings in PHP to send them out, as well as that it seems to be optimized around this sort of HTTP 1.1 behavior, which to compare against HTTP 2, there's not really any cost to additional connections in HTTP 2. So I think it still remains to be seen how much benefit it provides in the real world with the ongoing evolution of some of these technologies. One personal interest to me that I haven't really experimented much with yet is trying to combine ESI with BigPipe, where that if those additional content chunks that we want to ship out to the browser are cacheable, then at the risk of having to bootstrap Drupal again for those, which is a high risk if those things miss the cache often, we could be trying to push those into the kind of Varnish layer or Nginx layer so that rather than pumping a long string through PHP, we could be having it hit those caches and return those additional units of content much faster. So I still think there's some maturity and experimentation to be done with it yet.
And I would just throw out, BigPipe is super cool. It's a really interesting, and it's really great that it's in Drupal core, because it's the kind of thing that if you're building your application from scratch that you might have to like do a 6-month refactor to even make possible. And the cache layer that supports it can support a lot of other interesting things that we'll be able to develop in the future on top of Drupal 8 that will potentially give us more flexibility in addressing some of these situations. I would also say that I think the number of cases where BigPipe or ESI are actually called for is very, very small. And I always, whenever we talk about these really hot, awesome, bleeding edge cache technologies, I kind of want to go back to what Nate said, like start with your page cache and like figure out when and how to use that and figure out how to do all of the fundamentals of performance before even entertaining, do we need these extra sort of cutting edge technologies? Because they are much trickier to implement, much more complex. And I think people sometimes they go after those things first and maybe get in a little bit over their head and miss out on a lot of the really big wins that are easier to get and honestly will matter a lot more to end users. I always go back to the old what would Mark Sonnenbaum say? And it's just like this picture of Mark Sonnenbaum looking all skeptical and it just says, stop thinking about ESI, turn on your block cache, right? It asking yourself, do I need this highly, highly powerful but also very complex solution and like complex to implement solution versus a simpler solution that is much more stable and will give me everything that effectively that I need and get my users to be happier way faster.
And honestly, yeah. I've been seeing a transition over the past 5 to 10 years that there's a greater partition between editorial control of site content and site visitors in the sense that things like commenting often move to tools like Discus and whether you want to use Facebook or the Google Plus ones or any of those kind of options, none of those require dynamic interaction with Drupal. And The whole idea of user-sourced content has really been refactored into a lot of what social networks own now. And the idea of, say, creating a Drupal site where a regular user can go there and upload their images or videos is not really a design pattern that is that common anymore, compared to managing that content at an editorial level. So more and more sites are delivering pages to regular visitors as if they're anonymous, even if they're getting customizations from things like social networks. As far as Drupal is concerned, the user is anonymous. And that means that the full page can get cached in something like Varnish or a CDN.
Yep. And that's a pattern that has been super common. Like on like the Grammys, for example, we used to actually encourage people to log in and create an account. Now, of course, that seems ridiculous that you would ever log into, you know, a website like the Grammys so that you could post comments, right? You expect that you can post comments anonymously, not anonymously, but through a service like Discus or Facebook. And they're using Facebook as a great example. And that is loaded via Ajax after the initial page load. So you load the whole page. It's super fast because it's the same for everybody. And then that dynamic bit that lets you comment is loaded in after the fact.
That's actually kind of like the first decoupling of Drupal.
Yeah, it's like the pre-decoupled Drupal is actually just like the Ajax-enabled Drupal, which is definitely like a much faster, cheaper way to go than a full decoupling.
Progressive decoupling, I think, is the trendy term.
That's right. I forgot that was the correct term for that.
So let's talk a little bit about CDNs. It's kind of, I think back to, several years ago when I really got started working at Lullabot, and CDNs were the big, fancy, expensive, big sites need a CDN. It seems like now they're more and more available to people who might want a CDN that previously that wasn't an option for them.
Well, part of it comes down to how HTTPS is expected on sites. It was only a few years ago that Google announced that HTTPS was something that would factor into search engine rankings, and that browsers like Chrome would get increasingly skeptical of pages delivered without it. And the reason why I bring this up is that negotiating an HTTPS connection requires at least one or two additional round trips in addition to whatever else is being done to load the page. So having the server, as far as the browser sees it, be close to the browser, the site visitor, becomes more and more important.
Yeah, and technology has moved forward quite a bit as well, to where the types of things that people used to have to do to run CDNs, you know, the game has really changed. If you look at the from our perspective, kind of the two new kids on the block in the past decade anyway, I think of Cloudflare and then Fastly. Cloudflare, of course, is like, they're like, everyone can use Cloudflare for free, which is super awesome, and that really changed the market. Fastly has taken kind of the enterprise grade value of a CDN that used to only be available if you could afford the 7-figure deal to buy Akamai, and they've made that something that, like, you know, while it's not free for everyone, it's like very affordable for sites. Like, you can get up and running with Fastly without having to have a huge budget. And those are actually fundamentally based on Nginx and Varnish. Like, the two new web server technologies were then used by new businesses to essentially like deliver CDNs in a whole new way that really democratized that capability. And it's really good for users. Like David said, like if you want to be able to do HTTPS and not have to have, like, again, HTTPS increases the cost of the speed of light for a site, because it means more back and forth. And if that back and forth is over a long distance, Nate was saying, even if your Drupal page cache is working, you just added potentially 200 to 400 extra milliseconds of network latency, because the back and forth to set up the HTTPS connection just takes more back and forth. And so being able to take that HTTPS requirement and move it from the origin, from wherever Drupal actually lives on a server, to the network neighborhood of the user, means that you can, you know, deliver HTTPS without actually introducing very much of a performance penalty and potentially improving performance if you didn't have that CDN in the first place.
Can you talk a little bit about HTTP2? I know that HTTPS is required to use that, but my understanding is with HTTP2, you don't have the negative ramifications of having, you know, multiple large number of HTTP requests.
Yeah. So there's the sort of calling back to our earlier discussion, to kind of walk through that very fundamental timeline of the things that have to get set up before you can even see your web page. There's the initial Here's things that don't change, right? You still have to do a DNS lookup. You still have to do your initial TCP negotiation. You still have to then negotiate HTTPS. And then the beauty of HTTP 2 is from that point going forward, you use that connection that you just set up to run a lot of, you can multiplex the connection. So you request the first page, which tells you everything else you're going to need. So that can only happen, that's still a single request. But from there, that same connection that you're using can actually be used to run multiple concurrent requests to fetch the JavaScript, the CSS, the images, et cetera, so that the page can render. Prior to HTTP 2, what would happen is to do the concurrency, you would have to actually renegotiate new connections for each concurrent thread. So, like, if you have a web page, like the average number of assets that a web page loads to be complete is like usually, I mean, an economically constructed one is in the mid 30s. It's often over 100, and so you really need this parallelization because otherwise you'll just be kind of bottlenecked. But if each time you want to set up a new parallel thread to fetch things, you have to do a DNS lookup, establish the initial TCP connection, go back and forth two, potentially even three or four times to set up HTTPS, and then use that request, that's just adding, you're basically like paying that penalty over and over and over again. That's the world of HTTP 1. That's where you get people's, you know, guides to front-end performance from a few years ago that are all about like adding a bunch of different domain names to things, because then you can trick your browser into starting more parallel requests. All these kinds of hacks that people used to get around the fact that we were building heavier and heavier web pages on a protocol that was really designed for the original web, which was maybe there'll be an image, you know, like maybe we're going to have an extra request or two. HTTP 2 is totally changes the nature of that, because it could be very efficient with negotiating a single connection and using that for everything else. The other thing that HTTP 2 brings to the table, which requires, it doesn't just magically happen, and actually doing it right requires a bunch of careful thought. So it's kind of like Big Pipe and ESI and other stuff, where don't actually go down this road unless you really know you need it, is you can start doing push, which essentially allows you to have not just the normal back and forth of, hey, website, give me the core HTML that I can then parse and figure out what else I need. You say, hey, website, I require whatever's at this URL, and the back end can actually like push everything that's required to render that down the pipe in real time. So one connection and you get it all. It's kind of like how people, the poor man's way to do that is like inlining all your JavaScript and CSS so that the browser gets it in that initial request. But that is actually kind of hard to do, and it makes your DOM really ugly, and there's a bunch of downsides to it if you have a complex site. HTTP2, in theory, allows us to build web applications that do that while still maintaining the kind of component severability and not having to cram everything into one, you know, massive fat file that we push down. There are actual, like, really, there's a lot of complexity in dealing with that, though, because you don't want to push things unnecessarily, because that eats up a lot of bandwidth, especially on mobile devices, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole lot to dig into there, but it's a capability of the protocol that simply wasn't possible before.
And I expect that unlike ESI and Big Pipe and stuff, those are advanced, and so is push right now. But I think that push at least has the potential to get integrated as a sort of built-in thing in the same way where I believe it will probably be the successor to the sort of CSS aggregation and JavaScript aggregation in Drupal core, in the sense that those technologies basically become obsolete with HTTP 2 because of the parallelism. And then whatever mechanisms we were using before to figure out the mapping of what pages needed what resources will also help us figure out what to push. But I think that some of that will have to wait on some of the advancements coming down the wire on the standards track that are things like cache digests from the browser, where the browser basically gives a lightweight representation to the server of, here's what I have on hand so far, so that the server knows what it lacks. Because you don't want to just promiscuously push every single resource of a page down, even if you're dealing with desktop browsers.
Yeah, because the fastest cache is the local browser cache. And so if you're pushing everything all the time, you're basically not using that at all, which is not optimal.
But it may open up some opportunities for changing the expectations around cache lifetime for some of these things. Like right now, if you use an analysis tool for the front end and you have a cache lifetime of less than a year for some of your static assets, it'll complain about it.
Once we have the ability to freshen things through pushing, where we don't have to wait on extra round trips for that stuff, and do so in a kind of judicious way where we're only really doing it when it's necessary, then we may not have to be so aggressive about having excessive cash lifetimes for these things. Yeah. And we might even be able to throw out some tricks like naming CSS differently with different deployments, because if we can have shorter cache lifetimes in browser caches and in the CDNs, then we can actually, without paying a performance penalty, then we can throw out more and more of these hacks.
Yeah, and really what we've done is we've built like a giant pyramid of hacks. Like the substitute for like pushes, like if we need to expire something, we'd like tack on a query string, right? Yep. And the query string rotates and that forcibly expires caches, because of course the browser doesn't have a cached copy of that. And CSS aggregators, like we just talked about, like we aggregate them together to reduce the number of separate HTTP requests. And on top of that, like if you run a media heavy website, you get these domains, run into the connection limit per host, and then you end up setting up things like, you know, image.example.com or cdn.example.com just to get more host names. Mm-hmm. So you can do more simultaneous HTTP requests per host. And so all of those hacks all just get swept away
with HTTP too. Remember there was a Drupal module, I think this was around Drupal 6, that would do that. If you just had multiple DNS pointers to your same Drupal site, it would kind of randomly change your assets to, you know, multiple different servers, so you could, you know, download more than 6 concurrent assets at a time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, you're www.www.2.3.
Yeah.
Like, those are the most obvious ones where you just number them.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I mean, if Drupal is going to move to just pushing, assets down, that at that point, that's going to require HTTPS, which of course,
it doesn't actually require that. The HTTP2 spec, when it got finalized, dropped that requirement.
Really?
Yeah,
it dropped the requirement, but no browser supports it yet, even though it's not in the spec, which is kind of. You kind of wonder what battles are being waged within.
Yeah, so that's consistent with some of the other ways that browser builders are pushing HTTPS, not just Google and Chrome, but Mozilla and others. In addition to on the user side, like they're getting more and more aggressive about popping warnings up if you fill in any kind of user-generated mm-hmm. content over HTTP. On the developer side, all of the hot APIs that you can use in browsers to do next-gen things like location and real-time connection.
Service
workers and so forth. Mm-hmm. They don't work under HTTP. Yeah, and that's actually not in some cases there's probably some security considerations, but it's not really a security or a technical thing. It's this is how we want the web to work all the time, and we're going to hold all the carrots for getting the cool stuff you want behind the get your stuff encrypted wall.
I listened to a podcast, and I can't name it right now, but they had someone from Chromium, the Chromium team on, talking about HTTP2. And my understanding of that was that when they implemented HTTP2 over non-encrypted, the web, what ended up happening is that various different layers and caching mechanisms throughout the web and routers tried to cache stuff, and it just ended up breaking everything. So the only way that they were able to reliably do that is over HTTPS.
Huh. That's pretty clever. I'm guessing a lot of these routers probably don't have any awareness of anything newer than 1.1 then.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Memcache and other sort of things that used to be kind of standard that you'd have to install along Drupal. I know that Memcache was, if you had lots of interactive content, user accounts, that kind of thing, Memcache helped offload those cache tables from your database and really speed up page loads. Is that something that's still kind of in vogue?
It's not so much about speed at this point, because in terms of just the raw performance, if you look at how InnerDB is performing on MySQL these days, it's highly competitive when the database has enough resources. The real benefit to using something like Redis or Memcache is
for when you're scaling up the site. You basically get to take some of the burden off the database because there's really no single thing in Drupal that has as much responsibility piled onto it in a way that can't be shared as much as the primary database. And the more that you can take load off of that, the more that you can free it up to do the most important work that only it can do. This is true for the page cache. We talked about that earlier with things like Varnish and CDNs. This is true for Drupal's internal cache, where if you're starting to, like if you're seeing performance metrics in something like New Relic, where it's spending a lot of time reading from and writing to cache tables, then that's something to remove from the database. And the other case in which I've seen it be something worth doing is in newer versions of Drupal, I believe 7 included, we're starting to use transactions for a lot of database connections, and including the cache changes in the transactions can sometimes cause some issues on very high traffic sites because the transactions try to keep track of all the cache activity as well as what's occurring for the real database operations, and that makes the transactions larger. It means that cache things might get rolled back in weird ways that cache operations might not be expecting. So that's certainly a concern. There's some conversation happening upstream in Drupal core about standardizing cache tables on the memory engine in MySQL, which improves the performance and pulls it outside of the whole transaction layer of InnoDB to avoid some of those issues I was talking about for transaction rollback. But I don't know if that's actually going to go in or not. There are definitely some downsides to making that move. But by and large, I would say that unless you're actually overloading your database or you are experiencing issues with transaction rollbacks with concurrency, there's not a lot of reason to assume you need to rip the cache out of the database, other than the page cache. The page cache should always be removed from the database just because Drupal is just not that fast with it compared to a CDN or Varnish. But for its own caching, until you hit those points, you're not actually going to see a major change.
Yeah, and to be clear, David, you mean that you shouldn't, like the Drupal page cache, no matter what your cache backend is, Redis, Memcache, or the database, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter which it is, because you're still using PHP to get to that layer. You want to put all of your page cache even in front of, you're not even hitting it in the first place.
Correct. These backend caches, like Memcache and Redis, have a limited amount of storage in them. You're going to tune them for a certain amount of space to take. And you don't actually want that to be too high, because if it's too high, then the cache is actually going to spend a lot of time doing housekeeping. This is also true for some of the caches in MySQL itself. A bigger cache is not always better. I would say that you really don't want a cache of more than about a gigabyte for a Drupal site. If a gigabyte's not enough, then you kind of need to rethink what you're storing in it. And the reason I bring this up with respect to the page cache is that the page cache does a really good job of crowding out your cache and pushing things you actually want in there out. Because every time someone loads a different variant of a page, if you have the Drupal page cache enabled, it will write that to the cache backend. And then Memcache will throw out a whole bunch of things that you actually want cached in order to store those cached pages. So it's just not that great from a performance basis. It's not that great to have it crowding out other things in your cache. So it's really the number one first performance thing that I would do to any Drupal site is turn on the kind of page cache headers and put something like Varnish in front.
And that's like, I think that's, that was our experience when we were doing performance consulting and performance audits, which admittedly is a little bit dated, as for me at Chapter 3 and David at Four Kitchens in our previous lives. But that's also, at Pantheon, kind of what we tried to build in. So like, that was just the way it worked out of the box, right? Every website would just get Varnish immediately and you wouldn't have to actually worry about that set. Now you still have to make sure that you didn't screw it up somehow, because depending on what you're maybe doing with Drupal, it could break. But out of the box, that should just be like working for you turnkey. I don't know if it's appropriate to talk a little about the CDN work that we've been doing lately. Yeah. But the whole goal with that was to take that same philosophy to the CDN and the HTTPS level, And so we actually partnered with Fastly to build our CDN. And since Fastly's based on Varnish and we were originally based on Varnish, we were able to take the whole experience of running Pantheon, that kind of turnkey integrated Varnish page acceleration, and then just extend it through Fastly. So now it's like, instead of running on Pantheon with Varnish, which was always awesome, you're now running on Pantheon with Fastly's Varnish, which is distributed across 40 different locations all over the world, and they've done a bunch of internal optimizations beyond that. So it just like got all the benefits of Varnish and moved it like 1,000 miles or more closer to the end user to cut down on that speed of light. And then we were able to work with, again, leveraging some of Fastly's internal dev tools and Let's Encrypt to provision certs for every site and stick them at the edge too. So we can do the whole HTTPS at the edge and the whole page cache at the edge. And that all just kind of magically works out of the box, which we're really proud of, because that's like kind of gives you, again, it's not everything you would need to do to optimize your design. It doesn't help you with thinking about the CPU load of your JavaScript. It doesn't necessarily solve problems you might have with like third-party ad services that your boss tells you have to be on the page but are like slowing things down. But what it does is it basically takes all the things that like are unambiguously correct and smart to do from a performance standpoint in terms of technology and makes them work together immediately. And then that, you know, you have to verify that still fits your use case and everything. But as a developer, it means you can focus much more intensively on the things that are really specific to your application, to your use case, and where, like, again, puts you right into that cutting edge space, I think, of where the performance game really is, which is thinking about front end performance as an application problem, not as like a layout problem.
And, this gives, compared to sites that don't have this, it gives you basically a head start on the race. That you're getting hundreds of milliseconds back that you might have otherwise had to worry about, because the time to first byte is going to be, you know, depending on where you are and how close to the point of presence you are, it could be under 50 milliseconds.
So is this for all Pantheon sites? So if I sign up for a Pantheon site, you know, today or tomorrow, I'll go ahead and get a free CDN and an SSL certificate?
Yep.
That's pretty awesome. And what about, I'm assuming this affects like retroactive sites. Is there a button that they have to press to upgrade or anything, or is it just automatic?
So it's automatic for, it's automatic except if you are already using our kind of legacy HTTPS service, because at that point you're going to need to change your DNS to point away from that service and towards the new CDN edge. So there is a button in there, and we kind of have a little wizard that'll help you through it, because we can't provision the cert from Let's Encrypt until you can prove you own that domain. So if you want uninterrupted service, there's a little bit of a process that you'll need to go through. But it doesn't take more than, you know, 20 minutes to go through, and then you update your DNS, and that takes time to propagate. But it's like a relatively simple operation, all things considered.
Okay. Go ahead.
We also don't charge for it, unlike the old system. We were charging $30 a month for the legacy HTTPS because we provisioned a load balancer, and we sort of passed through that cost. And now this is bundling that with all the sites with no additional cost or no plan restrictions.
Awesome.
The Lullabot podcast really skews heavily toward Drupal, but at Pantheon, you're also involved with hosting WordPress. Is anything different when you're hosting a WordPress site as far as the technology stack goes?
Nope. It's all Pantheon all the time. We have so in WordPress you call it a plugin, not a module. So we have a plugin that allows people to take some more advantage of the cache. Let me take a step back. One of the really awesome features of the way that we architected the implementation with Fastly, which is it's an underlying capability of Varnish, but like we really put a lot of thought into how this works, is the ability to dynamically expire things from the cache based on what they call surrogate keys, but it's like kind of like cache tags. And Drupal 8 has this whole like Drupal 8's caching system and this fit together like peanut butter and jelly. It's awesome. and there's you end up in there, like, some use case specific decisions you might have to make around how you use views and a few other things, but like it's exactly what you'd want from a developer's perspective in order to be able to cache the content for a long time, because you're not ever waiting for caches to expire, because you can have Drupal dynamically poke out all the things that are now out of date as those things get get updated or new content is added. So you never have to do a complete cache wipe unless you're debugging something that's just like not working correctly. And even under those circumstances, you have other options. So that's like super duper cool. And it's we have a little integration module because obviously we have to call an API on our side, but that leverages Drupal 8's internal stuff. And we've worked with Fabian from Tag One to backport a lot of that capability to Drupal 7. So there's like a Drupal 8 cache module for Drupal 7 that gives you all this if you want to have Drupal 7 sites take advantage of it, or for other reasons you like cache tagging and want it to be there in Drupal 7. On the WordPress side, it's the same Pantheon stack through and through, but we had to basically write a different plugin to be able to have some of those same capabilities. And in the WordPress, it's interesting because it's such a it's a much more productized piece of technology that has like WordPress has like just stronger opinions internal to it about what you're doing. Like it says you've got the author page, and the author page lists the posts of the people who wrote them, and you have posts, and if you can have custom post types, so they all essentially behave as posts. And so our plugin for WordPress is able to just kind of ride on those opinions to do a bunch of the same things, so that if you a new piece of content gets posted by an author, we can clear the author page, etc. Because we can just assume that all those things are basically happening. And then, of course, just like with Drupal, there's a PHP API if you want to establish your own rules for how you tag things and how you clear them. But out of the box, the goal is to be able to do one better than classic Pantheon of just being able to use Varnish, but actually be able to use it in this dynamic a way where you're able to set your cache lifetimes up so that more people get that super fast response from the edge, but also have content be refreshed dynamically, like in real time. The time it takes to clear those things from like 40 points of presence around the world is under a tenth of a second. It's awesome. Fastly's technology is super, super awesome. It's been really great working with them.
Now, does Fastly give you HTTP2? And the reason I'm asking is because I saw that Drupalize Me was hosted with Pantheon, and when I see a website redesign, I always kind of audit it. Just look some. Like that, and I thought it was using HTTP2. So is that like a thing?
Yep. It's in there. We haven't talked a whole lot about it yet because we're gonna put together like because there's some things that are beneficial about it out of the box that you sort of again you don't have to think about like multiplexing requests. It's just good. But if you want to maximize your use of HTTP2. We're going to put together some documentation on how to think about that as a developer. You know, before you get into HTTP push or anything that's crazy advanced, there's some other like thoughts about just the best way to set up your Drupal when you know you're going to be under HTTP2 to get your page render time way down. So I also did like a bunch of benchmarking. So I used a web page speed test. They have a private instance thing where you can just set up your own copy of web page speed test and tweak it and run it for your own purposes. So I did that when we were rolling this out. We had an early adopter wave, which was like a couple hundred websites that were on our legacy HTTPS service and then switched to the global CDN because, you know, it's better and also they could save some cash. I was able to benchmark before and after sort of like us against us, Pantheon Classic versus Pantheon Global CDN. And we got like even just inside the continental United States, there's a significant speed up. And then like I also measured it from like the a location in Asia, and like it's a dramatic speed up. But the really cool thing was I was looking at some of the sites that were like, oh my God, I can't believe how fast this site is. And I looked at it and they were sites that had, you know, intentionally or not, I actually don't know, they were just structured in ways that worked really well with HTTP2. And they were like, you know, they also didn't have any of the anti-patterns for front-end performance of like blocking super long to load ads. But there was like a bunch of sites that were at the head of the class in that group, and they were doing full page renders in like under a half a second.
Right on.
That's delighting users to no end. It was really sweet to see.
So it sounds like I've kind of, to summarize our conversation today, I think there are three things, and Josh, I think they're probably kind of a misquote of what you had to say. You just have to get your technology right, configure your CMS right, and then build your application the right way, and it's all going to work out. Three different tiers.
Yeah, it's so easy. I don't understand why everybody doesn't do it.
Right? Hey, thanks for joining us. David, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Just that this is not even the end of the improvements that are kind of coming down the wire. I know that part of the team at Fastly is working on the Quick protocol, which is another iteration on HTTP2 that takes it to UDP to cut out yet another round trip. Whoa. So that sort of stuff will just kind of come down the wire for the way that we have global CDN set up. Won't require any changes to Drupal, won't require any retesting of the site. It'll just get a little bit faster as each of these kind of technologies rolls out. And then TLS 1.3 is also coming down the wire, which further improves on even the optimized versions of the TLS 1.2. That will improve negotiation speeds, as well as the switch to more and more of the elliptic curve algorithms. Those are faster to negotiate. Like, there's just actually a lot of passive improvement that's going to be happening over the next 12 months with no changes to websites.
Cool. Oh, that sounds awesome.
Josh, do you have any final thoughts today?
No, I mean, of course, I always have final thoughts. I spent the first part of my career as a performance-minded person just like kind of almost exclusively focused on the server side and the back end, and I kind of got more serious about the front end really only in the past 2 to 3 years, I'd say. And I think I would just want to reiterate my point about the reputation that front-end development has as being kind of the less technical end of web development was always a misconception because it was always incredibly important. And at the end of the day, we are here to build things that serve humans, and humans interact only with the front-end. They don't really care about your server. And there's always been a huge amount of technical detail that is incredibly important to delivering that end value, which is a person interacting or seeing something. And that's just, you know, I would say at this point that front end as a development practice area for performance and for other reasons, just from an application development standpoint, I think that is where the real action is. And so for all of my peoples out there who might be having a back end performance background and mindset, you can come to the front end and do a lot of damage, and it's a lot of fun. So I'd say check it out if you haven't already, and we'll make much better websites and web experiences.
Nate Lampton, what do you think?
Well, yeah, we said it a couple times. There's so many awesome technologies that are out there to really optimize websites beyond where, like, the fastest that we have now, we can make them faster yet. And that's going to continue to improve. But if you have not a fast website right now, you have a slow website, there's probably something that is, like, critically broken, like, at your application layer. That is, like, number one thing. Like, all of this stuff, it's all, like, yay, that's all great that it's available. But if you're taking more than a second to respond right now, that first byte time, you know, you're definitely in a problematic spot. And look at your application and find out why your caching isn't working. Even turning on the page cache in Drupal, you can check the box, but that doesn't mean that it's actually working. So if for any reason, if it's taking more than a second to get that response back, start at the beginning and find out why your caching isn't working, because all of the subsequent layers will all fail if the first one isn't there in the first place.
Right on. Mike Herschel, go forth and make fast websites, huh?
Yep, I agree. Will do.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Lullabot podcast. You should reach out to us on Twitter @Lullabot or leave a comment on the podcast node.
Yep, and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. That's how people find us. And leave us some comments on the podcast page, too.
The node, right?
One configuration change, you too can host your entire website.
Yeah.